It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's been about 5 months since the Milwaukee Bucks were eliminated from the NBA playoffs. Their shot at redemption starts tonight. We'll take a look at this year's team and how they stack up against the rest of the league coming up.
First, this has not been an easy year for farmers. Trade tensions are making it harder for them to sell their products in other countries. And low commodity prices mean even when they can sell, they're not making as much in return.
On top of that, there's also been another issue, really bad weather, with heavy rains and flooding in the Midwest that have damaged crops or in some cases prevented planting altogether.
Our next guest says climate science shows us that this is becoming the new normal for farmers in the Midwest and across the country. And some farmers say that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is doing little to help them adapt.
Helena Bodemiller-Evich is a senior food and agriculture reporter for Politico Pro. Helena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go to the big picture here, you visited some farmers really feeling the brunt of wild weather this year. Can you talk about some of what they had to say?
Yeah, I think a lot of us, you know, we're eating every day. We're maybe using fiber grown by farmers, but we're maybe not thinking about what farmers are going through right now. This has been a really wild year in terms of extreme weather. We've had an incredibly wet year. We've set records on precipitation much of the country, and that has resulted actually in 20 million acres not being able to be planted, which is really record-breaking. And that on top of the trade tensions you mentioned in the intro here, you're having low commodity prices and at the same time, really, really tough weather conditions. So combining that with some of the flooding we saw in the spring, we've also had hurricanes and wildfires in the last year. So taken together, it's just been a really tough year.
And when you talk to farmers, are they looking at this weather and thinking and talking about climate change? Are they worried that this is the new normal?
So the term climate change is still pretty polarizing, but definitely a majority of farmers believe the climate is changing, which I know sounds like a strange distinction, but the term climate change has just become so politicized and so, I think, associated with Democrats that if you separate it from the politics, there's definitely a growing recognition that the climate is changing, that weather is becoming more volatile and extreme, and farmers are talking about this. They are looking at ways to become more resilient. And what my story found is basically the Department of Agriculture is very hesitant to talk about climate change. And that's really becoming a barrier for farmers getting access to help.
Right. What kind of things are we hearing and I guess not hearing from the USDA, the Agriculture Department?
So USDA does not really use the term climate change, does not talk about climate change as a concept directly. You don't hear top officials talking about it. It is very much a topic that they tend to avoid. However, there are still these regional climate hubs run by USDA, which are carved out across the country. There's 10 of them. And these hubs, which are very low profile and under the radar, are still issuing quite frank warnings and assessments and also coming up with tools to help farmers adapt to climate change. So they're not only, you know, really raising awareness about the risks and the causes and all the effects of climate change, but they're also focused on helping farmers and ranchers adapt. The issue is they're kind of in a politically hostile environment. So a lot of the farmers, the vast majority of farmers and ranchers I talked to for this piece had never heard of the climate hubs, were not aware of the resources that they've been putting together. So there is a big gap between the realities on the ground, the warnings coming from scientists, and what the, you know, political leadership at USDA is actually willing to talk about.
Can you talk about the origins of those regional climate hubs?
So they started during the Obama administration. They really got off the ground right towards the end of the administration. So they were kind of barely up and running and operational by the time the 2016 election hit. And at the time, a lot of scientists and agronomists and weather folks who worked at these hubs, they thought actually the hubs would get eliminated because, you know, you had President or then candidate Donald Trump talking about how he believed climate change was a Chinese hoax, didn't believe in the science. So there was a time when people thought that the USDA climate hubs that had just been set up would be eliminated. What I found is that's not what happened. They were not cut and they were not shut down, but they just have gone into really a quiet mode to avoid sparking political ire or any kind of controversy. And that really has resulted in this big gap between, you know, the work that USDA is still doing on the ground in some places and what farmers and ranchers are actually hearing from USDA and actually getting from USDA in terms of help and also an honest assessment about what's going on.
Talking to Helena Bottomiller-Evich from Politico Pro. She reports on food and agriculture there, talking about climate change, how a changing climate is affecting farmers around the country. And she writes that the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, isn't doing very much to help farmers around the country adapt to a changing climate. Helena, in the scope of the resources of the USDA, how much goes into things related to, again, adapting to a changing climate?
Yeah, so it's a very small percentage. The $144 billion agriculture department, which of course is highly involved in everything from, you know, subsidizing crop insurance to doling out loans for farmers to, you know, of course, running major nutrition programs. Less than 1% of that budget is dedicated to climate adaptation. And a very, very tiny percentage of that is actually what's spent on the climate hubs. The climate hubs are about $11 million a year in this, you know, massive department. There's about 35 employees full time in about 100,000 employee department that are really focused on climate adaptation. Now, I should say, to be fair, the Department of Agriculture, their response to my story was, you know, well, you have to look at all the conservation programs we run. And, you know, there are some environmental benefits to these. They're not what we came back with is, you know, these programs are not designed to help farmers adapt to climate change, but there are some environmental benefits. If you were to look at all those programs, that's about 4% of USDA's budget. So however you want to shake it, the actual focus on resilience and climate adaptation in changing weather is a very small drop in the bucket in a large department.
And you write that there was a vision at one point under the Obama administration that not only could they help farmers deal with the impacts of a changing climate, they could help farmers be part of the solution by helping them change practices to actually absorb carbon on their lands.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting distinction. So there are two words that we use in terms of agriculture and climate. There's adaptation, which is helping farmers and ranchers, you know, become more resilient to whether it's, you know, extreme rain or periods of drought. So there's that part. And then there's the mitigation, or what you just mentioned, which is having farmers actually be part of the climate solution. Because if you change practices or you focus on different ways of farming, you can draw carbon out of the atmosphere and actually be part of, you know, mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. So there definitely has been a movement away from talking about mitigation or being part of the solution for farmers and more of a focus on adaptation, even though that focus has remained pretty low profile in terms of the work that USDA does. There's a lot of grassroots energy, though, around this idea that farmers could be this really important part of the solution. And I think going forward, we're going to see more activity from food companies, from agricultural businesses, from farmers themselves actually saying, you know what, we want to be part of the solution. We recognize climate change is real. And I think you're going to see more activity at the ground level, kind of regardless of this weird political situation that USDA is in.
We're talking to Helena Bottomiller-Evich, food and agriculture reporter for Politico Pro. She's with us to talk about her recent piece on the USDA and climate change.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the federal government should be doing more to help farmers adapt to climate change? Maybe you're a farmer. What has climate change and the weather that comes with it looked like from where you stand? Are existing problems like federal crop insurance enough for a future with more intense weather? 800-642-1234. Give us a call or email at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Keely Boltina. We're picking up our conversation about how climate change affects farmers and what the federal government is and isn't doing to adapt.
Helena Bottomiller-Evich is with us from Politico Pro, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen farms in your area damaged by wet weather this year, last year, year after year? Are you in a community where farming is a big part of the local economy? What have down economic times for farmers meant for your part of the state? And if you're a farmer yourself, how has weather affected your business this year? Would you like some guidance from the federal government about how to change the way you work to adapt to a changing climate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll bring on a caller. Michael is with us in Bear Valley. Michael, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, a number of years ago, I heard this concept of carbon credits, but they've always been applied to big oil companies and not to private landowners. For example, banking carbon in woodlands and in fields that have been taken out of corn production, et cetera, seems to be creditable. And I'm wondering if you know of any organizations or legislation that is looking at this, especially on the local level.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Helena, you are right in your piece that people were looking maybe for an incentive to do some of the things Michael is talking about. Is there anything out there?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I think this is sort of the direction that a lot of leaders in agriculture and you know the environmental movement hope that we will eventually go, that farmers would get compensated for capturing carbon and sequestering it in their soil, or whether or not it's, you know, trees or other greenery that's set aside on their farm. There was actually a carbon market several years ago, but after cap and trade failed, maybe 10 years ago now, that market collapsed. And so a lot of, I think, farmers are waiting to, or hoping that eventually we'll get to a place where they could be credited for their carbon sequestration. There are some efforts in the private sector right now. There is a company based in Boston called Indigo that is, I think they've enrolled something like 10 million acres to pay farmers to sequester carbon. But these are, you know, kind of cropping up in different places because there's no federal, you know, cap and trade. There is no major tax on carbon. And so without that, it's difficult to figure out how you pay people for sequestration. So I hear this a lot. I think there's going to be a lot of experimentation that happens. But in terms of like whether or not Congress is about to do this, we certainly don't see any legislation that's imminent.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Helena, I know farmers very concerned about crop insurance, especially with the risk of bad weather, maybe preventing a harvest or even preventing planting. What are people looking at in the USDA in these hubs when it comes to the future of crop insurance and what it costs?
So crop insurance, I think, is proving increasingly critical for growers that are dealing with this extreme weather. It gives them enough certainty usually that they can get from year to year, whether or not they're prevented from planting or they lose, you know, a major part of their crop due to extreme weather. So it's definitely a stabilizing factor in terms of income. But the Economic Research Service within USDA recently put out a report that found crop insurance is going to become much more expensive, or likely to become much more expensive for taxpayers, because over time we're going to be paying out more and more, and that's going to raise premiums and just the overall cost of running these subsidized programs. So how much we can just continue to rely on crop insurance to get us through is unclear. And I think we're going to start hearing more and more about how these existing programs might be leveraged or adapted to the changing environment that we're in.
Talking to Helena Bottomiller-Evich from Politico Pro, talking about how a changing climate is impacting farmers, flooding and drought, raising the risks for farmers and their crops. And the USDA, she writes, not doing a lot to help those farmers adapt. You can join in with your thoughts, maybe your experiences as a farmer, at 800-642-1234. 1-2-3-4. Helena, how are people at the top of the USDA these days talking about climate change when they're talking about it at all?
Well, it is rare for them to talk about it. But when I think Secretary Perdue, the agriculture secretary, has been asked about climate change, he tends to sort of, get around the issue. He'll say things like, well, you know, some people think it's human caused, some people think it's not. And he'll say, you know, farmers and ranchers are already doing a lot in terms of conservation. But they really, it's not something you hear frequently discussed. It is not something that's brought up. Really has to usually be a reporter kind of needling an official to say, you know, what are you doing about this? It is just not a priority or top agenda item.
How about people at lower levels? And we've talked about this a little bit on the show before. Do they feel like they can use phrases like climate change? Do they have to dance around it? How is this trickling down to the lower levels of the USDA?
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. We definitely see less use of the term climate change in this administration. And some of that, you know, is probably a result of self-censorship, you know, officials saying, well, you know, if I can just use the word climate variability or volatility or weather extremes, maybe that's just an easier route because they recognize that top officials either don't believe in science or don't really want to be talking about climate change. So there's that element. But the climate hubs are this really interesting exception within USDA, where if you go to their website or you go to their Twitter account that has, you know, just a few thousand followers, USDA climate hubs, they're using the term climate change liberally. They're using it every day. They're saying climate change, agriculture, they're connecting the dots. They're talking about record temperatures. They're retweeting NOAA. They're talking about disaster payments and how those could increase with increasingly volatile weather. They're really issuing frank assessments. But if you go to USDA, you know, the head Twitter account, they haven't used the word climate. Forget the word climate change. They haven't used the word climate since 2017. So there really is this gap between how kind of down in the trenches scientists and, you know, officials at USDA are talking, and then how the leadership is talking.
Let's bring on another caller now. Adam is with us in Grays Lake, Illinois. Adam, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Adam?
Yeah, my question was, it appears that farmers have gone all in for, you know, Trump and the Trump administration, whether it's true or not. And I wonder, going forward, do you see that affecting the general public's willingness to continue, you know, bailouts and, you know, and things like that for farmers?
Adam, thanks for the call. Helena, I know you were talking to the farmers about the weather and how it affected them. Did they bring up politics much at all and whether or not they support the current administration?
So politics definitely comes up, but I will say that traditionally in my conversations with farmers, it's hard to generalize. But I think overall, if you were a strong supporter of President Trump in the last election, I'm not hearing a lot of farmers run away from the president. Certainly there's frustration. There's frustration about the trade war. There's frustration about some of the politics around ethanol and the renewable fuel standard. There's frustration, but I do not hear like a mass exodus happening from farmers by any means. That said, there definitely is a lot of anxiety. Generally, there's economic anxiety. And I think the question that the caller just asked about how long the public will be okay, you know, continuing to spend money to help farmers is a really interesting one. I think if you set the support for Donald Trump aside, you know, even just with the trade war, we've spent $28 billion in 2 years on trade aid for farmers because of the trade war. I don't know how long that can continue without there being, you know, some level of public backlash to say, look, at a certain point, we can't just keep spending billions of dollars to keep this going.
Thanks for that call. We'll go now to Dennis with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. What effect would carbon sequestration have on the land and whether any crops would grow or which crops could be grown?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Is the USDA doing that kind of research, Helena?
Really great question. So actually, I mean, the good news about carbon sequestration is it tends to make soil actually more productive. So there are a lot of benefits. You also, a lot of the practices that draw carbon into the soil actually improve soil like structure. So it's better able to handle extreme rain. You can have less runoff. There are numerous benefits to the practices that go well beyond just carbon sequestration. So the good news on that front is you really could be looking at like a win-win-win if you could get these practices to be adopted more widely. I think most people recognize that's going to take incentives and education and research and a real focus on doing that.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. If that kind of research and focus isn't coming from the federal government, do you see states or counties or extension agents, you name it, taking the lead?
There's definitely more activity on the state level and at land-grant universities. I know Iowa is doing a ton around soil health. They've had a lot of water quality issues. Maryland and some of the Chesapeake Bay watershed states have been really focused on cover crops, which are one of the practices that can not only help draw carbon out of the atmosphere, but also improve soil health. So there definitely is activity. There's a lot more activity once you look outside of USDA. There's food companies that are looking at this. So we're seeing, again, like some grassroots energy. It's just kind of this weird dynamic that USDA doesn't want to talk about, like the climate nexus at the same time.
And briefly, Helena, as we wrap up, are you seeing pushes from Congress to nudge the USDA on climate change?
So we actually just learned this week that Senate and House Democrats had, you know, they asked for an inspector general, a USDA inspector general investigation into USDA's handling of climate science and communication. And that inquiry has already begun. So there's going to be more accountability around how USDA is conducting this work. And I think we're going to see a lot more come out about what they're doing and what they're not doing.
Helena, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks.
That's Helena Bottomiller-Evich, senior food and agricultural reporter for Politico Pro. She was with us today to talk about her recent report looking at the USDA, farmers, and climate change.
Coming up after the news, we'll preview the Milwaukee Bucks' quest for an NBA title as they tip off another season tonight. I'm Keely Boltina.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Keely Boltina. Coming up, we talk about an open letter to Governor Evers urging him to grant Brendan Dassey executive clemency.
First, the Milwaukee Bucks tip off the regular season tonight when they take on the Houston Rockets in Texas.
After losing in the NBA Eastern Conference Finals last year, the Bucks are contenders to take the whole thing. In fact, Las Vegas is giving the Bucks 6-1 odds to win the league championship.
Led by reigning MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo, the Bucks have pretty much the same core as last year's team that won 60 regular season games, but with a few significant changes.
Zora Stevenson is the Bucks' new sideline reporter on Fox Sports Wisconsin and the digital reporter for Bucks.com. She talked with Central Time producer Bill Martins.
How excited are you to cover the Bucks this season? I mean, this has got to be huge.
I mean, to have your first year in the NBA be with an organization like the Bucks, it's really amazing. I'm so excited for this opportunity. I kid you not, everybody within this organization is simply amazing. They're so helpful. They're so kind and genuine. And it's been a really, really nice transition.
Well, good. Glad to hear that. You know, a lot of people are high on the Bucks this year, including sports writers, analysts, even league general managers. In fact, I think I saw something, 76% of GMs said they'd win the East, and more than a third of them said they'd win the championship, second only to the Clippers. Remind us what makes them so good.
I think what makes them so good is the stuff that doesn't show up in the box sheet, right? It's the way they practice every day and get after it. It doesn't matter if it's a drill or if it's a scrimmage. These guys are so competitive. And then on the flip side of that, they're amazing human beings as well. And I think that goes a long way. I mean, there's no riffraff going on between guys. They genuinely care about one another. And that translates into success on the court. So I think their mindset – and their approach to this game is number one, why they are the team that they are, the work ethic. And then obviously there's a million great pieces, and it all starts with Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Absolutely. And I saw that he was quoted somewhere as saying after the Bucks went up 2-0 against Toronto in the Eastern Conference Finals that he thought he'd be playing in the NBA Finals. Instead, of course, they wound up losing the next four. But how motivated do you think the Bucks are given how last season ended?
Oh, motivation isn't even a question. I think, you know, it's obvious that they didn't end the season the way they wanted to. And the goal right now is just to get better every single day. If you ask anybody, whether it's Coach Bud or anybody on the team, they just want to get better every single day. And that starts tonight with Houston.
And as we mentioned, Giannis, the MVP is back, and he seems to be the early favorite to win it again this season. And I don't know, it doesn't seem like there's a ton that he needs to improve on. What has he been working on over the summer and early fall?
Well, if you talk to Giannis, he'll say leadership was a big focus for him. And obviously, he's already a great leader, but he really just wants to focus on some of those skills, being a bit more vocal. That's something that he talks about. But, you know, I think the best part about Giannis is the fact that he's his biggest critic. I mean, there was a preseason game, and he had a double-double. And I said, you know, how do you feel after this game? You know, you said you're trying to get back into shape, trying to get into the swing of things. And he had a double-double. I believe it was the Utah game. And he goes, I'm rusty. And I said, but you played great. And he said, it's not about the stats. It's about all the other things, about getting up and down the court. It's about screening for his teammates, looking for his teammates in the open court. I mean, this guy is – he's a basketball mind.
Yeah.
He's thinking about the game in so many different ways. And I think that's what really makes him so great. And I think that's why he won the MVP last year.
And he's only 24. I mean, by NBA standards, he's not even in his prime yet.
And he'll tell you that. He'll tell you that he has so much more to do when it comes to his game. And sky is the limit for this young man. And I think it all starts with his personality and the way he approaches the game. He makes it all about his teammates.
We're talking with Zora Stevenson. She's the Bucks' new sideline reporter on Fox Sports Wisconsin and the digital reporter for Bucks.com. She's given us a little season preview of the Bucks. They tip off tonight against Houston. You know, Zora, in addition to Giannis, a lot of familiar faces are back this year. Chris Middleton, Brooke Lopez, Eric Bledsoe, George Hill, just to name a few. Let's talk about some of the big departures from last year. Who's gone?
Well, I mean, the biggest one we know of is Malcolm Brogdon. And a lot of people have been asking, how is that going to work? He was such a valuable piece to last year's puzzle. But it's a new season, new team, and there's so many new faces. The general manager, John Horst, just did an unbelievable job in the offseason to bring in some quality additions to mix with the core that you just mentioned. So we're talking about Wesley Matthews, Kyle Korver, Robin Lopez, Dragan Bender, Giannis's brother, Vanassis, is on the team. There's just so many different pieces, and they all bring different things to the table. Wesley Matthews will be in the starting lineup tonight.
And he's a Madison guy, by the way. He went to Memorial High School and then went on to play at Marquette University. So aside from just being a Buck, that's a good reason to cheer for him.
For sure. And he's so excited to be back in Wisconsin. Kyle Korver has a relationship with Coach Bud from Atlanta, so they have that chemistry going on. Obviously, you know, it's great for Giannis to have his brother there, and they'll tell you the big draw for them to have Vanassis come was so that he can see Alex, the youngest brother, play in high school. So there's just so many different storylines, but they all bring different things on the court, and I think collectively that's going to help fill any void that there might have been with any departures last season.
And talk a little bit about Robin Lopez. You mentioned Giannis and his brother, but the Lopez brothers are there as well.
They are. And what an exciting thing for both of them to be on the same team. And, you know, for the team to have two true centers, that's going to be really impactful. Brooke gets the starting nod, but to not have any drop-off, if you will, and then Robin pick right up where he left off, that's going to be really valuable for this team this season.
Part of the reason so many people think the Bucks are going to win the East is because of, you know, Toronto, who beat them in the Eastern Conference Finals. They lost their best player, Kawhi Leonard, to the Clippers. So which team in the East do you think may give the Bucks the most trouble this year?
you know, there's so much talk going on right now. If you ask anybody in like mainstream media, obviously they'll bring up the Sixers. But for me personally, I just think it's so early to have all these predictions. Anything can happen. If you ask anybody on this team, they'll tell you they're just focused on themselves. They're not really bringing up who they're worried about going into the postseason or anything like that. And I think that's what's so great about this team is they really are just focusing on themselves and trying to block out all the noise. But anybody watching that's a fan of basketball, you can't help but get excited for all the different movements that happened in the offseason. You know, it left the East looking a little bit different. Obviously, the West looks completely different. But that's just the excitement of the season. And you really don't know what's going to happen with all these different players and different markets and on different teams. Obviously, they're talking about the dynamic duos coming together. And it'll just be exciting to watch, and we'll see what happens. We can have our predictions all we want, but we don't really know what's going to happen.
Right, exactly. Well, as we wrap up, Zora, what are you going to be watching for in tonight's game against Houston? It's a tough game.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's so interesting because from the outside, we know about Let It Fly from this team, but from the inside, defense is at the core, and defense is the identity of everything. You've got Eric Bledsoe up at the top, and he'll be matching up probably against Harden, and that'll be great to see. But what's interesting is he gives all the credit to his rim protectors, talking about Brooke and Giannis, because he says he can't do what he does defensively and really wreak havoc on some of these guys without rim protectors. This team really has a system when it comes to defense, and everybody has a specific role. If you really watch them, their rotations are on point, and everybody's always in help and talking and communicating. So I'm just going to look for things on the defensive end. I think that's going to be the key for tonight.
It's going to be a fun game to watch. Zora, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zora Stevenson is the Bucks' new sideline reporter on Fox Sports Wisconsin and the digital reporter for Bucks.com. She previewed the team's season with producer Bill Martins. The Bucks open regular season play tonight at Houston, then host Miami in Milwaukee on Saturday.
Coming up, Brendan Dassey's legal team released an open letter today urging Tony Evers to issue a pardon or commute his sentence. We'll talk to Dassey's attorney coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, if it feels like you never see your friends anymore, you're not alone. Find out how our changing job schedules may be hazardous to our social lives.
First, the legal team for Brendan Dassey released an open letter to Governor Evers today asking him to grant executive clemency.
Dassey was 16 when he was first incarcerated in connection with the death of Teresa Halbach. He turned 30 this Saturday, and he isn't eligible for parole on his life sentence until 2048.
Earlier today, I talked to Dassey's lawyer, Laura Nyreiter. She's also co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. I also talked to Jason Flom, host of the podcast Wrongful Conviction, who interviewed Dassey on his show. Laura, you petitioned Governor Evers for executive clemency for Brendan Dassey. Now we have this open letter out today. Can you talk about the importance and the significance of the letter and the people who signed it?
Sure thing. This letter represents an absolute groundswell of support for Brendan Dassey that we are delighted to see. The letter has been signed by more than 250 voices, leading voices from around the country, representing everybody from former senators to formerly incarcerated people who are joining together and asking Governor Evers to grant clemency for Brendan Dassey.
And tell us exactly what you're asking the governor for. We hear words like pardon, clemency, executive clemency. What are you looking for Brendan Dassey?
Sure. We and our supporters are asking Governor Evers to consider either a pardon or a commutation for Brendan Dassey. A pardon would have the effect of immediate release. A commutation could have the effect of immediate release. It simply involves shortening the sentence. So there are two viable options. They're well within Governor Evers' power to grant. And we look forward to working with the governor, to having him speak with members of our team, to having him dive into the record in this case so that he sees that the just and decent thing in this case is to grant executive clemency to Brendan Dassey.
And people may have heard a lot about this case, but in a nutshell, why do you think this kind of clemency or commutation is justified?
Absolutely. Brendan Dassey, as a 16-year-old special education student, was sentenced to life in prison based on a confession that is now almost universally regarded as false. And this open letter includes folks from the highest levels of the United States government to the American Psychological Association to former prosecutors to law enforcement authorities who agree with us. that this confession is false and that Brendan deserves to be free. You know, we came within about 12 hours of getting Brendan Dassey out a few years ago after a series of federal judges ruled that his confession was involuntary, coerced, and false. We came within 12 hours before that ruling was blocked by a federal court of appeals that held, among other things, that just because a confession is false doesn't provide a legal requirement that a conviction be overturned. One of the dissenting judges called that a profound miscarriage of justice. This is a classic case in which the court system is not able to deliver the justice that Brendan Dassey deserves. That's why we're turning to Governor Evers to be the fail-safe that the system needs to do justice for Brendan Dassey.
Jason, you got the opportunity to meet with and interview Brendan Dassey. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah, it was a troubling experience. I mean, even after 25, 26 years of working in this field, I haven't met anyone quite like Brendan. He's a simple person who just wants to go home. I mean, obviously everyone in the system wants to go home, but he doesn't, I get the sense he doesn't fully understand why this is happening, because he doesn't have the type of mental acuity that a person of his age, you know, would have. And in fact, his growth was further stunted by the fact that he's been caught up in this nightmare since he was really a child. He was 16 and he wasn't a fully developed 16-year-old. So it's, you know, it hurts my heart as a parent, as a freedom fighter, and as a human being to see someone who's so vulnerable, who has been so badly taken advantage of by people who should know better.
For people who haven't listened to your podcast before, Jason, can you talk about how Brendan's case compares to some of the others you've featured?
Yes, and thank you for asking. One of the things that's so troubling about Brendan's case is the false confession aspect of it. And the fact is that we know now that false confessions are a significant factor in approximately 25% of all wrongful convictions. And that number is going to be staggering to a lot of people, because almost anyone you meet on the street is going to say, I would never confess to a crime I didn't commit. But you would. But the fact is, every person that I've met in this work has a unique story. Some of them were victims of these type of coercive interrogation techniques. There are seven or eight factors that we see again and again in these stories. But everyone is a human tragedy.
I want to give a listen to the voice of Brendan Dassey. This is from your interview with him, Jason, after you asked him about being interrogated, whether he was scared, what he was thinking in the process. Here's a listen.
Well, I just wanted it all over with, so I said whatever they wanted to hear, you know.
And I want to bring you back in now, Laura. You watched the interrogation, I believe, fairly early in your legal career as you got involved in this case. What did you take away from watching the interrogation of Brendan Dassey?
You're exactly right. You know, when I first saw the interrogation videos of Brendan Dassey, I happened to be a law student. I wasn't a lawyer yet. I was a third-year law student here at Northwestern University in Chicago. And I just had happened to sign up for a class on wrongful convictions taught by Stephen Drizin, who is one of the world's leading legal experts on confessions, interrogations, and false confessions. And he had just agreed to represent Brendan Dassey on appeal. So he handed me the interrogation videos as his student and asked me to go watch these videos. And I took some home. I'll never forget it. I sat down on my couch, and I put these DVDs into my laptop, and I watched these four interrogations over a period of 48 hours, 16-year-old special education student, right, a kid who needed an aide to sit next to him in class so that he could understand what the teacher is saying, who's in the interrogation room completely alone. And my heart broke because I saw a child who is trying to please his interrogators by telling them what he thinks they want to hear. But in so doing, he's trying to confess to a murder that he couldn't describe, right? There's this heartbreaking sequence in the interrogation videos that's become notorious around the world among legal experts and non-lawyers alike, in which the officers who believe, based on their investigation, that Ms. Halbach had been shot in the head, you know, ask Brendan how the murder happened, and Brendan guesses wrongly every way he can think of killing someone. choking, stabbing, throat cutting. At one point, he says hair cutting. The officers are dropping him hints. Come on, Brendan, something with the head, something with the head. And he just can't come up with the fact that she was shot in the head. And he gives up. He says, you know, that's all I can think of. At which point the officers have to say to him, come on, Brendan, I'm just going to come out and ask you who shot her in the head. At which point Brendan says, well, that was my uncle. And they say to him, Brendan, why didn't you think of that? Why didn't you tell us that? And he says, because I couldn't think of it. You know, I've never before seen someone guessing in such a devastating way that wasn't recognized by the interrogators in the room at the time. And, you know, that's not a confession that anyone should have any faith in. It's a confession that when I watched it changed my life. I came back after graduating from law school and for the last 12 years have been working closely with Steve Drizin, representing individuals who falsely confessed, studying police interrogation, working with some of the leading psychologists around the globe who study interrogation. Some of their names appear on the open letter that was sent to Governor Evers today, and working with lawmakers around the country to reform the system, to learn from these cases, to build a road forward so that there will be fewer false confessions and more reliable confessions in the future. Now it's our task to make sure that road leads back to Brendan Dassey.
I want to listen to Brendan Dassey again. And Jason, this is you asking about his initial legal representation and how it made him feel to not have, in hindsight, great representation in legal defense. Here's a listen.
It made me feel betrayed and that I couldn't really trust lawyers either. But now I can.
Jason, talk about that. You briefly touched on that earlier, the idea of inadequate defense representation in some of these wrongful convictions.
The fact is, there are too many defense attorneys, and I have a lot of respect for attorneys in general and for defense attorneys. I think public defenders is a noble cause. It's not a high-paying job. And just say, but there are a lot of them who don't do anything. Or in Brendan's case, it's even worse because they were almost like adjunct prosecutors. They not only did nothing to help, they deliberately harmed his chances of getting justice and getting acquitted as he should have been. But there are too many cases, including both cases this week. I was in prison in Kansas, a visiting guy named Albert Wilson this week, who was wrongfully convicted. His lawyer called no witnesses. And then I went down to Texas. I was on death row with a guy named Rodney Reed yesterday. In Rodney's case, the same thing. How is that even possible? There were tons of them. If he had just done a rudimentary job, and it's horrible. It should sicken all of us because for people listening, if you don't think this can happen to you, this can happen to you. And that's a message that I get out there. And I hope that everyone who's listening, when you get that jury duty notice, because you're going to get one at some point and you're going to be annoyed. I can hear people already sighing. Oh, God, I hate that. But the fact is, when you get that notice, go serve on a jury and understand that what you're being presented with as facts may not be accurate. There may be innocent mistakes. There may be deliberate misconduct. There may be a false confession. There may be eyewitnesses who were either, you know, confused or scared, or, you know, there's a million factors that go on. But we have to do our best. These are our fellow citizens. They're human beings. And everyone is supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. Brendan Dassey was actually innocent. He was never treated as if he was. He was treated as if he was guilty until proven innocent. And unfortunately, that's the way our system works too often, is that once you get caught up in the system, you're done. And the mistake that Brendan, I mean, I wish I could go back in time and tell him this, but I'm going to tell people who are listening now. If you get picked up and interviewed by, you know, an interrogator, don't do it without a lawyer. To just say those words, I want a lawyer.
As we wrap up, Laura, what are you watching for next?
You know, we are watching and waiting and seeing a groundswell of support that's coming not just from around the country, not just from around the globe, but from within Wisconsin, too. We've had over 15,000 people sign a petition to Governor Evers asking him to look at Brendan's case and grant him either a pardon or a commutation, including more than 1,000 people from Wisconsin alone, all across the state, from Superior to La Crosse to Waukesha to Milwaukee to Green Bay to Madison to Manitowoc itself. We are so honored to stand with our neighbors and fellow citizens in the fight, and we look forward to working with Governor Evers, helping him see that the time is right to bring Brendan home.
Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Interviewer.
That's Laura Nyreiter, attorney for Brendan Dassey and co-director of the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern's Pritzker School of Law, and Jason Flom of the podcast Wrongful Convictions. We talked to them today about an open letter released today urging Governor Evers to grant executive clemency to Brendan Dassey. If you're looking for a haunted house this Halloween season, here's one to maybe steer clear of. A haunted house in Tennessee requires people to pass a physical, sign a 40-page waiver, and pass a drug test before they go in, because I guess it's so scary.
Okay, but also you pay in dog food for the owner's five dogs.
And you can win $20,000 if you make it all the way through. No one has claimed the prize yet.
Wonder why?
Road trip?
No, thank you. Yeah. I'll opt out of that one, Rob. Thanks.
Right. It's not clear in reporting on this what inside this haunted house is so very disturbing and scary. Yeah, I don't want to find out. I don't think
that no one has managed to get through. I mean, I don't want to go in a regular one.
I was going to say, are you a haunted house person?
No, please don't make me.
Okay, kids, do they like a kid-appropriate haunted house for you?
I have one kid who likes all things scary and is not afraid of anything, which kind of scares me.
It's been a long time since I've done haunted houses, and I got to say, I've done minor league ones at most.
Like, I know it's not real, but it feels too real.
Local teenager in mask. Woo. I haven't put myself to the true haunted house test, and I may never.
I don't know. If you do that, please just let me know. I'll help you put it together later, but please don't invite me.
That sounds like a good Wisconsin life. And I, haunted house.
Sure. We'll work on it.
Yeah. 2-3 years from now. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.